All right. Well,
let me get us started.
Guys ready?
Yeah.
Fire away.
Pour for the Course, episode 4. Welcome. Tommy, Matt, Dave. I'm Matt Milholland. I'll be your moderator for most of the conversation today. We're going to go over Urbana Country Club and, of course, a blind tasting of a bourbon. Little disclaimer, we are trying to get the formatting of episode 1 and 2 worked out and transferred over to our podcasting platform. So bear with us. The episodes might come out in non-sequential order, but we're working hard. We've got Columbus Country Club and Brookside Golf and Country Club reviews already recorded, and we're working with our IT interns, as I glance over to Dave, to get those things live. So today we're going to be doing Urbana Country Club, which is in Urbana, Ohio. It's a Pete Dye original design, and I think Tommy's done a little bit of historical research here.
Yeah. So club was founded in 1922, and Matt, please keep me honest as I go here, the member in the group. But it was founded by Paul F. Dye, otherwise known as Pinky Dye, who is Pete Dye's father, P.B. Dye's grandfather. He built the original 9, which ended up being finished in 2023. And from what from the research I did, you know, kind of the story seems to go that he's never played golf before. His car breaks down in Pennsylvania. And, you know, as he's waiting for his car to be repaired, he's got to stay overnight and is near a golf course. And so he hits some golf balls for the first time and plays 9 and got hooked by the game and, you know, came back to Urbana where, you know, they had a place and said, I'm going to build this golf course. And so built 9 holes. And then that 9 was for 70 or so years.
Yeah. Just a quick, I know what you meant, but, 1922 was the founding year.
Yep.
I think you said 2022 maybe. But that was our 100-year anniversary just a couple years ago. So
old course, lots of history. And then PB Dye built the new 9 in 1992 and opened for play in 1993. And it's believed to be the only course in the United States that was designed by a grandfather and a grandson.
Wow.
That's cool.
That's interesting.
So that's pretty cool.
That is very cool.
Which 9 did he first design? Which side?
The back 9.
The back 9. Okay.
Yes.
Yes.
And the number 10 today was not always the number 10. So I'm sure we'll get into some of the course layout changes, but yeah.
Yeah. Let's see what else we have here. So Pinky Dye, PB Dye, Pete in the middle is PB's father, but Pete Dye kind of grew up at Urbana. And I was listening to an interview that he did. And he said he was the greenskeeper there for a couple years in the 1940s. But according to him, he burned up all the greens the second year he was there. And so his dad told him he should join the service. And so he got out of there and I forget which branch of the service he did, but around World War II, I guess, joined the military. And after service, you know, obviously came back and had an illustrious course design career. Probably the best known of the Dye family, I would think.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Lots of famous pros have played there. Pinky used to like to have exhibition matches and bring people in. So, you know, he had names like Walter Hagen, Sam Snead, Byron Nelson, Jack Nicklaus, Chick Evans, all playing in events at Urbana.
By the way, Chick Evans has 12 club championships, but continue.
Wow.
The namesake of the Evans Scholars.
Yeah.
And then same interview, I was listening to Pete talk, and he said, you know, the year that Pinky had Walter Hagen there, you know, he was sitting with Pinky out on the porch of their house. They were just kind of talking, and he said he had some extra money that he planned to give Walter Hagen a bonus for coming out and playing.
Wow.
But Pinky's wife walked up on the porch, and Walter Hagen did not stand up to greet her. So he said he did not give him the bonus.
Wow.
$20? How much are we talking?
I think he paid him $500 to play.
Nice.
Wow. The beginning of Liv.
Yeah, right. So then the only other kind of fun facts I had were I read that it had the first bent grass greens in the country.
Really? Wow.
Whether or not that's totally true, I'm not sure. But I know, bent grass was being used out east. But
maybe there's something specific just to the greens.
It could be.
Yeah.
But sounds like Pinky had a relationship with Scott's, and they were doing some experimentation.
Oh, it makes sense.
Not a bad partnership to have.
With Ben, he talked him into coming and installing bent grass on the greens. And then the only other fun fact I had was PB still has a place there on the property and can often be seen riding in his cart with his dog. I think his name's Tika, riding shotgun in the cart.
Yep, the big yellow labs. So they love to swim in the ponds out in Urbana. So yeah. Ponds at a golf course aren't exactly clean, and neither are those dogs.
It's the one off of two, right?
Yeah.
That's his spot.
Yep.
With the island and the flag and the...
Yeah, it's a beautiful house off of the left side of number one green. Everyone thinks that is PB's house. It is not. It is the one that sits to the right of that house if you're looking at the back porch. So he's out there all the time. He splits time between Urbana and the Dominican Republic, and I'm not sure how often he goes to the DR anymore with COVID and how much golf course design he's still doing, like in his, older years, but he's around quite a bit. I mean, it's not uncommon to just be playing and he'll just pull his golf cart up, right up on the tee box and say, "How are you hitting them?" And he's got the most distinctive voice in the world. So, he's a fun guy. So, yeah. We've all played Urbana, so I guess what do you guys think? High level thoughts. We've played it multiple times. We've played it as a group. We've split up and played it.
I talked to talked about Urbana today. I was in a meeting for low voltage for a house that my wife and I are building, and the one thing I said, I was like, it's a very fair course. But if it's dry and hot, it is just brutal to play because it just, your ball bounces in places that you would never guess because it gets pretty rock hard. But I very much love the course. It's great.
Yeah. So Matt, what do you think?
Of the three that we play, I've always in my mind thought it's the toughest.
Really?
And I think there's more than the other spots, steep elevation changes, and it forces me, at least, to take longer irons, especially off the tee. Sometimes I think I need to hit a longer iron because I can't hit a drive, and it's a pretty lengthy par four, or the par threes are tough for me.
Our par threes are terrible.
They're just really tough for me.
Yeah.
And the one par three that comes to mind is the really one. It's a longer par three, but it's got that dead man's cliff off to the left. It's a pretty narrow
seven.
Green. If I
yeah.
thank you,
seven.
Pretty narrow green. If
we
I
call
remember.
It a par three and a half,
that's a good call.
Yeah.
I'm hoping to hit the fairway on that one.
Yeah.
And then hit a nice little wedge up to that tough green. So I just feel like I have to take longer irons and not really good with those right now. So I've always thought it's a very tough course. But I like it. It's fun.
Yeah.
It's one where most of my clubs are dirty afterwards. So I get to really put my game to the test. I'm not just driving and then wedge.
Yeah, absolutely. What do you think, Tommy?
I would say it's a little fair now that they've updated the rating.
Yeah, we got a rating upgrade this year, finally.
Really?
So we'll talk about the new tee boxes that have been added and our depressed rating over the past 2.5 years. So,
did we talk about this post-round one time over a couple of beers about how the rating needed to be increased, to harder?
Yeah.
I think we've talked about it several times.
Okay. Yeah.
And it got a higher ranking. Yeah, right.
This year. Yep. So I think it's fair from a handicap perspective now. But, you know, I think it's a good test of golf. It's got, you know, it's got most of the things that that you're looking for. And, you know, it's got all the way around. I think it's got challenging greens. You know, Matt, you talked about some of the fall-offs. It's not just limited to that hole. Like, you know, there's a lot of significant slopes to greens, places that, you know, you don't want to be above a hole. And so, you know, it really challenges you to hit it in the right spots. You know, there's holes out there that are some of the tighter driving holes that, you know, I know, and that, you know, I play a course that's tree lined just about every time. And there's a couple holes out there that are extremely intimidating off the tee. So, you know, I think overall it's a lot of fun. It requires you to hit a lot of different shots. You know, it requires you to, think your way around a golf course.
Yeah.
You can't just get up there and bang driver and hit wedges into greens, and you know, there's a lot of strategy and a lot of, you know, placement where you need to be,
yeah,
to score.
And PB did in my personal opinion, I think he did a pretty good job of matching up the old back nine with the, you know, the front nine that he designed. The greens have a lot of undulation on the back, they have a lot of undulation on the front. Some folks think that the front is more severe than the back nine. The front nine's definitely longer than the back nine, but I think he did a really good job. I mean, it's really hard to build nine holes 70 years later. Yeah. And yes, the land is very similar, but it's really hard to match those things up. You know, how many times does a golf course like build a new hole and then we go, oh man, you know, like this hole really doesn't fit. I've heard endless complaints about hole number 16 at Muirfield Village, yeah, Golf Club, right?
Yeah.
It's a beautiful hole. It looks great on TV. And when we were caddying there, we would just say, yeah, you know, this green, it's just not the same as the other ones. And then I went back a decade later and they said, yeah, that green's still not, you know, like the other ones. And this hole just doesn't play like the rest of the golf course. And so it's really hard. Mm-hmm. And I think he did a good job. And the front nine is what has been improved over the years. There's, you know, I'm not sure how much of this is rumor and how much of it is just is fact, but there's rumor or at least discussion among the membership that if certain changes are made to the back nine, the original 102-year-old nine at Urbana, it changes the insurance liability policy for the club, and hole 11 runs along the road. So there are some things that could be done to the back nine, I think, that haven't been done to the back nine, which is cool because it preserves the history. But you can see that there are some holes where they could lengthen or they could maybe do some widening or some narrowing. And if they make those big architectural changes, there's been a rumor that it would affect potential, you know, insurance claims if somebody like me blocks one out onto the road on 36 on hole 11. So
I'm glad you brought up the 2-9, because, you know, when I think about it, I agree. I think, you know, if you didn't know, you'd be hard pressed to, you know, realize that it was done by two different people, let alone two different people that far apart.
Yeah.
You know, I think the only thing, and, you know, it's really, you observe it as you know that it's different, but the only thing that I identify is, you know, off the tee, I think it's a little bit more friendly on the front. It seems like there's more room and it's not as narrow and trees everywhere.
Yeah.
But that, you know, I think that's a function of the land, and, you know, certainly have played golf courses where you've got two different styles of, you know, back nine, front nine that are built at the same time. So it's, you know,
yeah,
they did a really good job blending it together.
You'd mentioned Jack in 16, and I think he tinkers with that hole quite a bit. Does PB tinker with the front a lot, the one that he worked on and has maybe more freedom to tinker with?
Urbana is a course that is known for its laid-back culture and its laid-back membership. Until COVID, we had a strict no tee time policy. We had no tee time software. You called in and said, hey, I want to make a 2 o'clock tee time. They said, come on out.
You just put like a golf ball on a
Yeah, I mean,
shelf and the first one up goes first.
I mean, part of it goes to, you know, there's a bunch of guys and ladies that play at regular, you know, times during the day, and so they would just have their regular standing tee times and they could go out whenever they saw fit. But the other part of it is they really wanted it to be just a place to play golf and just hang out. Yeah. And so there's been – why am I giving you this backstory? Well, Urbana is not a place that is, like, flushed with funding, flushed with cash. We don't have a full membership. We don't have 500 golfing members, right? I think we're, you know, maybe around 200 golfing members, and it sits 30 to 40 minutes outside of the Columbus Outer Belt, right? So we don't get the influx of new folks that some of these other clubs with wait lists have had. And some of that is bad. Some of that is good. You know, I can still show up at 1 o'clock on a Saturday and they can send me off one of the three possible starting holes. So that's nice. But when it comes to a project at Urbana, it's usually well thought out. It's usually member funded. Someone funded a significant portion of our bunker renovation. I know who it is, but I don't know if he actually wants the credit. So I'll leave him off the podcast. But our bunkers are much, much better than they were 4 or 5 years ago. And there are 4 new tee boxes that have been added to the front nine. And PB told me specifically, I was playing the new tee boxes, I think like the second day after they opened. And I said, PB, you only changed the hardest holes. And he said, yeah, if you're going to make a golf course harder, you don't make the easy holes harder. You make the hardest holes harder. Mm. So number two, I already thought it was one of the hardest driving holes on the course. He took it back to like 470 yards, and the tee shot is blind with a hazard down the left. And you can't hit it right because there's trees right. Yeah. And
that's false. You can hit it right.
Yeah, yeah. Well, yeah. I own real estate on that right side, so just make sure you pay royalties. But and then hole six, you know, I ate lunch with some Raiders a couple weeks ago, and they said, yeah, we raided Urbana last year. I said, oh, which tee box did you play? And they said they played one up from the back tees. I said, well, the new back tee on hole six, you actually drive the ball over 5 green. And the guy looked at me as if I'd lost my mind. And PB took the hardest hole on the course, statistically, number 6, and he took the back tee box. He lowered it, which makes it feel like it plays longer. And then he also made the tee shot blind. So now you're hitting almost towards and out of bounds on the left instead of down the fairway directly from the previous tee. So there's some changes. Number 3 is historically known as a really, really, really hard par 3, and I don't think it's the hardest par 3 on our course, but they took number 3 from 165 yards to 205.
Three's the one with the green that slopes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Back to front.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Uphill.
Yeah.
Uphill tee shot.
And somehow normally into the wind.
Always into the wind. Yeah. So, there's... I think PB has done some tinkering, and I think he's done a really good job. He has certainly made the front nine much harder than the back. We continuously say out there, if you can shoot 38 or under on the front, and I'm saying, hey, if you're a scratch golfer, you go shoot 38 or under, then you're really feeling good going into the back nine. Because as Tommy mentioned, the back nine, you have to drive it a little bit straighter, but if you drive it a little bit straighter, you're hitting a lot of wedges. And some of the greens have mellowed out a little bit over the years, so you can get some flat putts as long as the greenskeeper didn't wake up angry that day. So, yeah. I mean, in the past, we've broken these courses down kind of like in sixth, if you will. So, like, yeah. I guess let's just tackle the first 3 holes out at Urbana. The, you know, hole one is straightaway par 4. Hole 2 is the very difficult downhill par 4 that doglegs right, and then hole 3 is an uphill par 3 with a very difficult green, and there's been some whining and some moaning about that green out among the membership, which
it's rough.
We can talk about.
I mean, it's rough.
Yeah.
I feel like
would you be one of them?
They redid 3 and 6 green, yeah, and they're just not the same. Yeah. Yeah, I would be in that camp because they lengthened the shot, which I'm totally fine with. It's fair to make a good player have to hit a 5 or 4 iron. But the green is less receptive than it was prior. And so now you're hitting a longer club with a less receptive green. So I don't like that aspect. When we get rain, it plays like a normal par 3. It's great. But it can be challenging in July, like Dave said.
Only the 11 handicap. 11 hardest.
That seems not right. But I can't imagine like a an average score there of lower than like 3.7. Like, it just like it feels like basically everyone's gonna bogey that hole, unless you're like Matt. Yeah.
I mean, I bogey it regularly. And
well, if you miss the green,
exactly,
you almost have no shot unless you miss the green short, and depending on where the flag is. But if you miss left or right, it's darn near impossible to get up and down effectively.
Yeah.
Yeah. Especially if it's hot, just forget about it. Or excuse me, dry. If it's dry, like the ball is, you might roll off the green.
So. No matter where you miss the green on three, I mean you're 6-7 feet below the surface. So, you know.
Yeah.
It and obviously there are spots where it just runs straight away from you, which being 6-7 feet below the surface and having the green run straight away from you is good luck.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean it's a hard golf hole. You have to hit a good tee shot.
Yeah.
Well, let's talk two for a second, because I feel like we skipped one of the more unique, fun holes.
Yeah,
it's hard, but it's really cool.
I like it.
And you can hit a good drive, or think you hit a good drive, and almost have no shot at the green. I feel like you go a little bit right.
Yeah. So not to cut you off, but
please,
with Urbana and with a lot of Pete Dye golf courses, I know that different family members did this, so I'm going to use the term Dye interchangeably here across the family. But with Dye designed golf courses in general, when you challenge the hazard or the dangerous part of the golf hole, you are rewarded if you pull off a shot. So on number two, the temptation is to hit it down the right center of the fairway or mm-hmm. the right side, which I do 9 out of every 10 times. If you hit it down the left side of the fairway and challenge the bunker and the hazard just left, and you do it, you get the flattest lie.
Mm-hmm.
You get a great lie. And you're like, what's so hard about this hole, right?
Other than the 180-yard downhill second shot that you face. But
and yes, a good view.
It's at least a flat lie.
Yeah, you at least get a flat lie.
Because I've been on the right side of that fairway, and you're staring at trees. No, knowing it's downhill, so it shouldn't affect me, but mentally it still does.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's a cool view.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, overall, those first three holes, I mean, you've got a nice little handshake tee shot off of number one, yeah. You know, a nice yep. wide. But again, like, you've got to put it in the right spot, because if you take too much club, you hit it left, you're blocked out by the trees. Same thing on the right. So, you know, you've got to hit the right club off the tee, but you do have a lot of room to play with.
Yeah.
But then you're met with an extremely challenging green. And then number two, like we've talked about, challenging tee shot, challenging second, challenging green. And number three, again, challenging tee shot, challenging green. Like,
yeah,
it is a tough first three holes of golf.
Every time I'm playing competition out there, I think if I can get through the first three holes one over,
yeah,
I'm feeling great.
Yep.
I'm like two over. If I can get through those first three holes and I'm like two over, I feel pretty good going into that par five. But so many times I have parred one of them, bogey one of them, and then I double one of them, depending. It might be the par three, might be the second hole. I don't know.
Yeah. But. No, it's quite the opening, like Tommy said. So once again, you know, novice golf architect person here, but
enthusiast.
I was always told that Pete Dye created golf courses with easy opening holes. And so crooked stick number one is just a short 350 to 370 yard par four. And the caddy said, yeah, this is the easiest hole on the course. Well, our original number one is the easiest hole on the back nine. And so the fact that PB, I don't know if he was trying to take a page out of his grandfather's book or if it just runs in the family, the easiest tee shot on the course is by far number one. You can, you know, push it right, pull it left, still probably going to have a shot at the green. You might eliminate your chance of making birdie if you don't hit the fairway, but you've got an easy opener. And then he just kind of like slaps you in the face with holes two and three.
Was 10 the original first, or you're talking 13?
13.
Okay.
Yeah. So hole four, you get some relief as long as you don't have you know, you're not playing the hole into the wind, but I think like hole four is very interesting because centerline bunkers are coming back as a golf course design. And you've got this giant fairway to hit into on hole four and then two bunkers, of course, right in the landing area as long as you're playing the correct set of tees. But if you hit the fairway, it's a great birdie opportunity. And
the next three are fun. I like the next three. And four, when you get up on the tee box, it's
gorgeous.
Just let's go.
Up on the tee box and when you get to the green,
yeah,
it's just like a really – and then obviously number five, you're like even higher up.
The view of the bunkers in the fairway is also cool, but it's a nice challenge. It's a I get up there and I'm like, yeah, I can do this.
Yeah.
Yeah. I wrote to take some words from the youngsters. I wrote it's a, you know, let them cook par five. As you step up there after the first three holes, that's kind of like, that's kind of how you feel. You're like, all right.
Yeah.
You're I got through the first three, one over, time to turn it on.
Yeah.
So.
Yep. Number five is a classic short par four. I think from the, literally from the tips, it plays 303.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Who made the comment earlier about the like wider fairways on the front? Was it you, Tommy?
A couple spots, but yeah, this is one of the
the largest fairways.
And there's a rock somewhere way to the left.
To be clear, the whole bends to the right. Missed the fairway on number five.
I was just gonna say the same thing.
If you look at the like Google Maps image of the golf course on the like the satellite view where it kind of shows the mat, like it is wild how much of the golf course hole number five takes up. Like it is a significant plot of land on the golf course for a 300 yard hole.
No, I'm curious. I mean, it's a huge section in the corner. That's crazy. Yeah.
All right. When you tee off on number five, little known fact, the rock in the middle of the fairway is actually in the middle of the fairway.
It doesn't look like it.
It is so far left of the green.
Yes.
And people say, well, what do I do? And I say, well, either commit to hitting a good shot at the green, which is guarded by bunkers with railroad ties, very typical die design, right?
And cool.
Or you can hit like a five iron at the rock, and people look at the rock and they go, oh, that's way offline. And I tell them it's actually a perfect angle to hit into the green, and it's dead center of the fairway. I've seen one person ever, one, actually hit the rock. And it's a huge rock. I mean, it's as big as – it's half the size of this room. So it's – massive.
Yeah.
I remember my strategy, one of the times we played was to do just that, go for the rock, and yanked, I think, a four iron severely left of the rock.
And that you're green, still okay.
And I'm still fine.
Yeah. Were you hitting from the cornfield?
I may have missed, probably. I may have missed the fairway like you, Dave. But that green is deceptive. It looks pretty tight, but it's fair.
Yeah.
And you've got green. And you've got a decent landing spot for your second shot.
Yeah.
It's a fun hole.
It is.
It's one you've got to look at where the flag is.
Correct. Absolutely.
On the tee.
Correct.
Because if it's there in the front and you're going to try and, you know, you're going to try and hit a 3-wood or a driver up by the green, like it gets tight. When it's in the back, you've got a little bit more room to play with and, you know, hit a wedge shot or hit a chip shot or, you know, whatever, but when it's in the front and everything's kind of sloping at you, and you know it's something you have to pay attention to.
I think the a pin in the front on five is easier to hit a full wedge to.
Yeah.
And a back pin is a very narrow landing area for a full wedge shot. So I personally like to try to chip the ball to a back pin, like hit it up around the green somewhere. The front pin, I've hit great tee shots that, you know, miss my mark by 3 yards, and all of a sudden it's like, well, outside of this Phil Mickelson flop shot, I'm going to basically be pitching this ball to 18 feet and trying to make an 18-foot birdie putt, and it just kind of feels like a waste. So it's a good hole in the sense that, like, if you execute your first shot, you're going to be rewarded. But if you're just a touch off, you can make a very easy bogey or par. And, I mean, nothing makes you feel worse than bogeying that hole, but it happens all the time.
Right.
Have you ever driven the green?
Yes. I made a two one time. And shout out to Andy Miller. Almost made a two. He horseshoed a putt on Tuesday night of last week. I hit 3-wood up like 3 yards off the green. Was feeling pretty good about myself. He hits 3-wood to like 12 feet. And
I could have swore the putt was going in, but it basically 270'd on him and he didn't make it. So
270.
Yeah, it was a little bit wicked, but
is that, it the most memorable hole? Or like if you go out there and play one time, I'm guessing that's the hole you're gonna remember.
I don't know. I have nightmares about seven, so
I was gonna say it's one of.
Yeah. 15's probably the most memorable.
15 was where my head went.
But number five, just a quick rumor before we go to number six, which just number six is, you know, diabolical. Yeah. But number five, the rumor is that there were no bunkers on the right side of the hole when it was first built. So there was a single bunker with railroad ties on the left. And it was grass up by the green. It was grass running all the way on the right-hand side. And someone went up to PB and he said, I know how to play this hole. This hole's easy. And he goes, you just hit a low driver and you just draw it and you just run it right up there on the green. And shortly thereafter, there were three bunkers down the right-hand side. And PB said, yeah, that strategy's gone.
Not anymore.
So, yeah, when you ask, has he tinkered with it? I think there's probably a lot of changes he's made over the years that I was not privy to. But that's a story that gets told all the time to where that guy came out, you know, a year later and said, oh, I have to come up with a new strategy. Either fly it or hit it at the rock.
That's cool.
Yeah. Six, you know, Augusta has names for each of their holes. Six would just be called hard. It's
the view is
hard.
Great though.
Yeah,
from the tee box.
It's real pretty.
But yeah, it's a rough hole.
I like the challenge that the green presents.
Makes one of us.
Yeah, right.
Well, it's
I'm never on the green.
Course.
Yeah, it's.
I'm typically off to the right in those trees.
On a course filled with narrow greens, mind you.
Right.
It's also maybe. Now this goes back to your question about number three green. It's competing with number three for firmest green. So it's now the narrowest green, and it is also the firmest green on the course, in my opinion. Yeah. Some people maybe think number three is firmer, but I truly do think number six is the firmest.
Doesn't make sense to me, given that it's shaded. It feels like they intentionally don't water it. And then that's – because normally, if you watered it just like the other greens, it would sit in shade for most of the day.
Yeah.
Or at least part of it, and stay wet for a long time.
That's a good point. Maybe because it's such a slope and
it
could
be.
The water
just
runs off.
It is pretty slopey.
Doesn't retain.
Just got to get the agronomy folks on here to explain it to us. I don't know.
I don't hit a lot of greens, so I don't have a complaint about the green.
I just, from that back tee box, I mean, you're sitting there staring at nothing. Like you're staring at a hill.
Two little
trees. In
front
of you. Yeah. Two little trees. And somebody's got to say, hit it there. And you're like, I can't see anything. And so you've got to trust that.
How long's the hole again?
429.
Yeah. So it's not a short I mean, like, it's not long, but it's not a short par four either.
But you pull off your tee shot. And mind you, the entire fairway is sloping down to the right.
Yep.
So like, you've got to hit it in the right slot on the fairway to get it down to the bottom to a flat lie. You pulled that off. Congratulations. Now you're left with
that's the easy part,
right?
The drive, honestly.
Yeah. But now you're left with a 9-iron, pitching wedge, short iron, something. What is it? 10 yards uphill, probably at least. So at least. To a narrow green that's firm as a rock, and
you legitimately can't miss left or right.
Right.
There is no good option.
The right side slopes all the way down to the next tee box. There's a bunker on the left, but the green runs away from you on that side. So it's like, again, you are required to hit a good iron shot to give yourself a chance to score, even to give yourself a chance at par.
But then luckily, after this hole, you get a really easy par three.
We can go to eight.
Well, God, let's just
hang on a second.
Before we jump away from six, correct me if I'm wrong, in the last review that we did on Urbana, didn't Dave, prior to doing the review and when we played, didn't he have like a sick up and down on six?
That sounds like him. I mean, a 15 handicap would never do something like that, which is why we
but
are
a 10
saying,
would.
Yeah, a 10 could do it for sure. So that checks out.
I might be a 14.
So nobody remembers, but I could have swore there was a time we were just like blown away by Dave.
So this is like a question I feel like comes up amongst golfers everywhere, but it comes up, on every hole at Urbana. So would you rather hit a shot that is below your feet or above your feet?
Above my feet, for me in particular.
I'd say the same. Playing baseball for a lot of years of my life, I feel more comfortable with that than really committing and staying down on a golf ball.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Matt's finding out you should pay attention to where the ball's at.
Matt's like, is there an option for just level ground?
Exactly. But even those shots, I find a way to mess up. Yeah. But I mean, they both make me unnervy.
Yeah. Well, the reason I ask is because, like, at six, okay, so Tommy and I are left-handed, and if you hit the fairway, you, as a lefty, are hitting a ball above your feet. And, you know, that tends to create a draw, which is a shot with less spin. And that's not good for the firmest, narrowest green.
No.
So there's been plenty of times where I've been in competition on that hole, and I have hit it down the middle of the fairway. And I have told myself, if I can pull off this shot where I'm, air quotes, hitting a cut with this ball above my feet and I can get it on the green, I've literally used that shot to say, like, this shot will win me the tournament. If I can hit this shot, I can hit any other shot that I come across today, because I just feel like it's that difficult. And as a righty, I don't know how you hit a shot on that hole, ball below your feet. You can't pull it. That's dead. You can't push it. That's dead. It's just a really hard shot, and I don't know how to execute it other than to just make your best golf swing of the day on that particular shot.
Yeah.
Sweet. It's what you're required to do.
Like, yeah.
There's no ifs, ands, or buts about it. You got a little bit of room short if you want to just kind of hit a little chunky one up there short of the green and try and get up and down for par. But, you know, it is a demanding hole for sure.
Yeah. Then, as you mentioned, Dave, you get relief on 7. I think 7 last Tuesday night was playing 231.
Yeah. From the overview, 236. It is the 7th hardest hole of the course.
That's a lie.
The fairway starts at about 150 yards. So if you've got a good 150 shot, you can be in the middle of the fairway.
This is a par 3, by the way.
What's the elevation? We guess, Matt.
It's a full club uphill.
Yeah.
Easy.
I'd say, too. It's...
Yeah. It's usually into the wind, so the general wind at Urbana is number 4 and number 7 run the same direction, and both of those holes are generally at least into the wind or maybe like a crosswind off the right-hand side.
It's gross.
I don't...
The front of the green's 213, so you, I mean, to get
I don't
on
really
green,
have a club that I feel confident
hitting 213 plus.
Yeah, like into a... Like, I'm like, yeah, I can hit a club 213 into a general area, but that's kind of what I'm doing on this par 3. I'm just like... praying that, like, I hit a decent shot, and if you miss left, like, you're in trouble. If you miss right, it's bunker, right?
There is no bunker, unfortunately.
It's like a hill.
Yeah, that's a hill. That's
a higher
right.
Higher hill.
And a cart path.
And a cart path.
Yeah. I'm just glad there's no caddies, because every time I take 4-iron, the caddy would be like, sir, you need driver. What are you doing?
I mean, shout out to, like, ego. Member at the club, Jerome Armstrong, watched him back-to-back days 1 year in the club championship hit driver on this hole. Hit the green both days.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, absolute
must
stick.
Have been serious wind,
just
too.
5-yard cut. Yeah, there's a little bit of wind. I mean, I hit Tuesday night. We played it dead into the wind. I was substituting for somebody, and the Tuesday night league is supposed to be a scratch league, and we were the next to last group to play this hole, and the closest to the pin sheet was empty. So no one had hit the green for the entire night.
Nice.
I did hit bunt cut 3-wood to about 20 feet behind the pin, and you might think, like, well, how close was it? It doesn't matter. It hit the green, so I won the award. So, yeah, sometimes you get lucky.
Good work.
Yeah. But it's just a really hard hole. So I mentioned if you can get through holes 1 through 3, 1 over, then you can, you know, as Tommy says, you can start to cook.
Two holes.
But yeah, but then 6 and 7 is like the same thing. I've always thought if I can par either 6 or 7 and bogey the other one, I'm totally fine. You get to move on to 8, play another par 3. So
I just want to bogey both par of those, 5. To be honest. Like, yeah. I don't think I've ever parred number 7. Yeah. So. Yeah, it's brutal.
It's a really hard hole.
I probably have parred it, but there's so many double bogeys that it just erases the par that I remember.
8, par 5. Unfortunately, if there is tinkering to be done, it would be on this tee box. It's the worst tee box on the course, in my opinion.
What's wrong with it?
And it's just not flat. Yeah. The hole is very reachable if you hit a great drive, so I wish that they would just flatten our elevated tee box and make you hit uphill more, and then they could, I think, have an easier job of making it level, but it's a great hole. You drive it. Once again, you challenge the left-hand side where the hazard is. You have a flatter lie to hit a second shot into the green, and you get rewarded for taking on the danger.
I love the last 150 yards or so of this hole. It's just so – it's such a cool approach shot. You know, you got the trees kind of blocking the right side, bunker. So, I mean, if you miss left, you know, on your approach shot, you got a bunker. If you miss right, you got a bunker. But, like, I mean, you also have to kind of decide and commit to if you want to, like, really go for the green on your second shot and just say, I'm just going to – if I end up in the bunker, great. You know, but I feel like I don't normally have that option. I'm normally like, let's just get it out to the left side of the fairway so I have like a 120-yard shot in. But it's a great hole. It's a great hole.
Nine? Pretty straightaway par four.
Yeah, when you were talking about the widest areas to drive the ball, nine came to mind in my head.
Which happens to be right next to number one.
Yeah.
So they share the same, you know, miss area, if you will.
But especially when you consider, you know, the ideal angle into the green is in the right rough.
Correct. Yeah.
So, you know, when you look at the left side of the fairway into the right rough, you've got many, many yards of space to play with.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But again, the protection is the green, and it's got multiple slopes, and it
the green has an unknown number of tiers.
Yeah, right.
Yeah,
so another one that just, you know, you've got to put it in the right spot, and you know, that's the protection for the hole. Otherwise, I mean, it'd just be, you know, bang driver, hit a wedge, and you know,
yeah,
do what you can.
Yeah, it's a nice finishing hole though, because it really tests you for at least five holes on the front nine, and then you get one to kind of hopefully get a par back. But you know, if you can steal a birdie, that's always good.
Wind direction pretty much determines how nine is going to either ruin your nine or help you. And when it's downwind, you're like, oh, this is like the easiest hole on the front nine, right? I mean, I remember, gosh, guy I play a pretty good amount of golf with, Zach Feely, who just nukes it off the tee. He had like 68 yards one time into number nine from the black tees. It was insane. And then there are other times where I've hit a full six iron into the green because it's dead into the wind. So it's wind dependent. It's pin position dependent. It's kind of PB die. You know, you're subject to the greenskeeper's mood of the day. Where did they put the pin? So
I mean, it's, you know, it's wide open. There's a bunker up the left. There's a couple of little scraggly trees in the right rough, but then it all narrows into that bunker short left, slopes around the green, undulating surface. So it's, you know, it encapsulates most of the rest of the nine as far as greens go. Yeah.
10, 11, 12. Head back to the original nine.
Did they change 10?
10?
10 still runs with the driving range.
No, that is 13.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I'm thinking of 13.
So that used to be, and I apologize if I'm wrong here because I am going off memory, but number 13 used to be hole one on the original nine.
Makes sense.
Then
right
when
next
they
to the pro shop.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Then when they built the front nine, they changed that original number one to be hole 10.
For some reason, I thought that was 10. That's my bad.
Yeah. And then years later, they changed it from hole 10 to hole 13, and they made hole 10 goes out. You walk past the swimming pool. You walk past the dining area. You walk past everything, the putting green, and you tee off like your
elevated tee box. Yep.
Heading towards the
tightest driving hole on the course,
yeah,
in my opinion.
Gracious.
Yeah.
I think last time we played there, I just got lucky, but I hit a good drive. But I kind of forgot that there's a branch that just sticks out literally right where you hit your drive. Mine must have missed it by 2.5 inches.
You could get a lot of people to sign a membership petition to cut that branch down.
But it changes. I mean, if it wasn't there, it would be a much easier driving hole for sure.
Yeah.
Or you can just ignore it and pray like I did. Sometimes it works out.
It's a great golf
course. I say 75% air trees yeah, or whatever right, the quota is.
Yeah.
Hole 11, I mentioned the liability policy on the back nine. Hole 11 runs next to the road. It's a par five. What do we think about this one?
Runs next to the road, but holy smokes. Like the slope from the roadside high on the left from left to right on that fairway.
It's like, wild.
It doesn't, you know. The fairway is fairly large, mm-hmm, just in looking at it, but in terms of where your golf ball can end up, it's not very large.
Yeah.
And, yeah, you know, just all of that slope down to that creek down on the right, coupled with the road on the left, like, it's another one of these just pretty darn intimidating tee shots.
There is a small flat spot in the fairway, correct? And is that, like, far left, or is that trickled down to the right?
You got about 5 yards on the left side of the fairway, yeah, where it's flat.
Yeah.
So you got to challenge the out of bounds, or you can hit it down on the right hand side all the way down, and your second shot becomes longer and yeah, up the hill.
Up elevated.
More so severe.
This is my point when it's dry, mm-hmm, and hard, is like you can hit it. Generally, if you hit a good drive when it's kind of wet, it's not going to, or not wet, just like normal, like it rained within the last 3 or 4 days. It just feels like the ball doesn't roll to certain places that make your life much harder. And then when it's dry, I just feel like I never know where the heck my ball is going to end up. Like, it might end up in a flat spot, or it might end up 20 feet off the fairway because it rolled so much. But
it's one of the tamer greens on the golf course. When you get there.
Yeah, my joke is, unless the pin's in the back tends to get some putts that move a little bit. But I always say if you, you know, think your putt's moving a lot, you're wrong on hole 11. That's kind of my quote. So I've been burned by that a couple of times. You know, I found out that the back of the green breaks a little bit, but middle to the front portion of the green, gosh, it's a lot of left edge, right edge, left center, right center putts. And it's really, once again, you can hit a mediocre tee shot. If you hit one really good shot, your second shot, you can be rewarded with an extremely easy chip shot onto the green, or even a putt for an eagle, and you can make some scores. But you're also one swing away from a double bogey, so you can hit it on the road.
Yeah. Once you get back up on that top part after you hit your second, it all feels fairly flat, and you know it's one of the flatter spots on the golf course that you're not dealing with all the undulation.
Matt, I think we've been down several times in that right area.
Yes.
Where it's like, it just slopes way off. If you just hit,
I'm
like
a very big fan of that aim target that stands pretty high above the trees. I'm always, always off to the right.
It's hard to lose a, well, I mean, if you hit left, obviously there's the road, but right, it's hard to lose a ball if you hit right.
I can do it.
I'm certain that I will probably do it next time we're there. But once you're down there, it's a rough go to get it back up to even a halfway decent third shot, which I've been down there far too many times, replaying number 10, apparently. But number 11.
We just talked about 11. Number 11.
Or excuse me, number 12. Number 12.
Number 12. This is what makes me think I'm a pretty boring person, because number 12 is arguably my favorite hole in the course, and it might be the most mundane course design par three of all time.
What do you love about it?
I think I'm just lefty bias, because the green kind of sits front left to back right.
Yeah.
And honestly, they did a really great job with the bunker renovation project. So now I feel like you have it's not a great chance, but you do have a chance of getting the ball up and down when you hit it in those bunkers. Our previous bunkers were just not good. And so we now, you have the ability to actually get the ball up and down if you miss, but it's just a good par three. The green is, it's challenging. It has subtle breaks, not major breaks, and they can change. This is another thing that goes, I think, underspoken, but they can change the hole just through the pin position. There, I have hit 8-iron, and I've hit 6-iron or even 5-iron, depending on where the pin and the wind is playing. So when they put it in the back right, it becomes a completely different golf hole than front of the green pin location. And I like that. I mean, when you have a green, like number three. Number three is a staple hole, but like you're almost always hitting the same club. Nobody looks at the pin on number three and says, oh gosh, it's in the front. I better hit a different club. No, you're pretty much going to hit the same club and you're trying to hit it to the center of the green. 12 is just easy enough to where it tempts you to say like, oh, the pin's back right. I can still get it close to that back right pin. You should just hit it in the middle, but you want to hit it to the back right. So I don't know. I think I just like that they can change it up. It tempts you. You can basically feel the architect saying like, yeah, hit it here. You've got a chance. And if you pull it off, like you truly do have a chance. I've almost made hole in ones on that hole, but I've also made double. So it's a typical Urbana golf hole. 13, most people's favorite hole in the course. Like we've said, the original number one and then number 10 and now number 13. So
it's very cool. Yeah.
Lots of ways to play it.
Yeah. What do you guys like to hit off of 13?
I think the last time I played with you and your dad,
I took three wood.
Yeah, I took three wood and still was flirting with the range because I yanked it. But yeah.
If I was playing it consistently all the time, I would probably always hit driving iron. Just because I feel like if I missed, I still have a pretty good shot at getting up and down for par even. If I like miss with my driver or which not what is it, 300 and
I mean you never miss with your driver.
Right. Never
325.
Yeah. So like if I miss with my driver though, I'm on the range and then you're never finding your ball. Right?
I love that it's later in the round because if I'm feeling my drive, I'll take dead aim at that left bunker and try and go for it. Now I don't remember a time where I've ever done that because I've always been intimidated, so I think I've always taken three wood. But I think we played around or we played mm-hmm. Matt when mm-hmm. and I think you tried to pop drive once, but
I hit driver almost every single time now unless the pin is back right. There's a little section of the back right of the green that I just don't feel like you can get any chip close to
because your hope is what that front green bunker, like that's worst case scenario for you.
Yeah, you can get in some bad spots.
Yeah,
but
I was going to say, are you so you're not nervous to get, because I feel like if you're in that fairway-ish bunker, that's a rough
that's
shot.
That's
the
worst
green.
Spot.
Yeah,
that's like the worst spot.
Are you,
that's a
you
miss
usually,
hit for you.
Usually clear that, though.
Yeah, that's 260. You're not.
Yeah, it's wind dependent. I mean, if it's into the wind, there's, in my opinion, there's no reason that you should be hitting driver unless you just have a different distance level than I do. Mm-hmm. But if it's not into the wind, the stats at least say that you're just better off to hit driver. So I would say I've made more easy birdies than I have made bad bogeys since I've started hitting driver on that hole. And my strategy is like if I get out of position, just pitch it to the front of the green. There's this nice little fairway spot in the front of the green and then just try to get the ball up and down for par. So I don't know if that's the right strategy, but I've tried to play that hole more aggressively because like to your point, Dave, I always hit four iron mm-hmm. every single time. And I don't know. I just like sometimes you hit a close wedge, sometimes you don't. But like we're all amateurs, so it's not like putting a wedge in our hand just automatically hits the ball to 6 feet. Whereas if I hit one decent drive, then I've got a chance to chip the ball to 6 feet. So that's kind of been my strategy on it. I've unfortunately convinced like two other really good players out there to be hitting driver all the time. And like I think Zach is, he might be hitting three wood now. I think Zach's hit it over the green before. And so sometimes I'm like, hey, why don't you hit four iron and I'll hit driver? but yeah, that's sometimes the way it works is other guys just are, people can just hit really great golf shots. So yeah.
That's a get me as close to the green as you can hole for me.
Yeah.
Whether it be a three wood or a driver, depending on the wind.
Yeah. Tommy's one of those people with a different level of distance. So
yeah.
Roast.
14 is usually the hole where the swearing starts. If it hasn't started already, but 14 is known for like just being a pretty handshake par four off the tee. You have a pretty wide area. You think, oh, the fairway is pretty flat. And then you hit the fairway and you've got just the most uneven lie you've been faced with the entire day. So I can name two plus handicap golfers I've taken out there that just have like gap wedge or pitching wedge in their hand. And it's baseball swing for a righty. And they just are like, what in the world am I doing?
Yeah.
So,
yep, been there. The that one, if I remember correctly, hard slope, like left, right
to left.
Yep, dogleg right to left.
Yeah, Yeah, that's yeah, so what do you normally hit driver on that one too, or do you like, is there a better way to play that?
Yeah.
What's the best way to play that? 3-wood?
Once again, wind determines a lot. I've started to go to like a driving iron or a hybrid, and I just hit it out there, and I've found that the pitching wedge or 9-iron from a semi-flat lie is just as easy as the gap wedge. For me as a lefty, like, feel like I'm squatting on the toilet to hit a golf ball shot. Yeah. That's just a really hard shot. So I've tried to lay it back, and I've watched people hit driver. You know, when somebody hits a driver and they hit drive it up in the neck of the fairway, it really makes you think long and hard, like, oh, I can do that. But your chances of hitting it in a 15-yard wide fairway, it's just hard, you know. Right. So it's a birdie hole. Like, if you can really, really make birdie on this hole, it's a very fair green. The putts for the most part are predictable. Like, you know where they're going to break because of the slope of the green. There's nothing tricky about it. And so if you can hit a great second shot, you can make birdie. And I think it's a great golf hole. It goes underrated, but it's just, it fits Urbana. You know, you can hit one good shot and you think you're good, and then you hit another shot and you're like, oh gosh, now I got to figure out how to make four. So it's tough.
Or seven.
Yeah. Well, I know how to make seven.
Where do I take my free drop off the 16 green?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. You can drive it on 16 green and apologize to the fellow players, but 15 is probably our most memorable hole. I mean, downhill par three, you know.
I forgot about 15.
I did forget about pond. It as well.
Yeah. Yeah.
Also green, seems to play into the wind.
It's a Butte Clark.
It does. The wind will really mess with you on this hole. I mean, it's downhill. We've tested it with some range finders with slope, and it's usually like 12 to 15 yards downhill. So it's severe. And boy, it's really hard to commit to less club when the wind is blowing.
Yeah.
And you're looking downhill and you're like, well, technically my ball's going to spend more time in the air. So, you know, what does that mean? But yeah, it's a great, great golf hole. And it is, once again, there are some of the most difficult pin positions on the entire golf course on this particular hole. There's also some of the easiest. So it's a fun golf hole. Usually a hole in one happens on this hole with a middle pin, and you can kind of funnel it in, but not for me.
No, but it's another one like you talk about where if you take on the trouble, you're rewarded with a good look, right? That green is severely sloped back to front. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if you play it safe and try to hit a middle back of that green, to a front pin, like, good luck. But, you know, if you take on the risk of the water a little bit more and can get yourself, you know, below the hole to a middle or a front flow, like, got a good look at birdie. But
yeah,
much easier said than done.
Yeah. I think, like, just 2 weeks ago, Dathel Palmer, a member at our club, she made a hole-in-one. So that was cool. Nice. Always nice to see people get rewarded with free drinks, but this is usually the hole where
you're not bitter at all.
Yeah, I mean, congrats, Dathel. Wish it was me. But
you're supposed to get the free drink.
Yeah, I did get one free drink, but I did see it on my bill, so let's get that corrected. But yeah, but this is the hole. Like, if you're gonna make a hole in one, you want it to be on 15. Like, yeah. You're not gonna see it on 7. You're not gonna see it on 3. 12's a maybe. You can probably see it on 12. Yeah. And 15 is like, oh, yeah, the postcard hole. That's where you want it.
Do they do anything to honor the hole-in-one at the club there?
I don't know. I mean, I'm the wrong guy to ask.
You got to have a plaque somewhere.
Yeah, do they do anything to honor almost hole-in-ones?
Yeah, no.
Do you have like net, 3 or 4 plaques?
What about net hole-in-ones?
Yeah, I don't think I've had any of those either. So, but we can ask next time. I mean, you're going to make a 2 on that hole, I think. You and Dave will be partners probably. He'll probably call it from the car.
I think I heard him call it earlier today, actually.
I got you, partner.
This is tough.
Dude, yeah. You got me all Bend and Dunes. We're going to kick the ever-living shh out of these guys in Oregon looking at the Pacific Ocean. They're going to rue the day.
Pre-calling partners is off limits now. You're just trying to capitalize on the 23 handicap over here.
Oh, man. And my 15 handicap.
I'm suddenly now all in on Dave's 15.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Yeah, I appreciate that.
Took me some time, but I finally convinced one of you.
I don't want to do it a disjustice because we are going to pour the blind bourbon here. But 16, 17, 18 are honestly three really good holes. So maybe each of us can kind of like highlight which we think is our favorite. But I want to leave enough time for us to go through the bourbon review.
18 finishing hole. So cool, man. It's just so cool.
So
it's bad when you obviously hit a bad shot and like people are out on the patio watching you, but generally it's a pretty freaking cool hole.
Not to skip over 16, but remind me, 17's tee box on the par five is slightly elevated.
Yes.
But the fairway dips down and then comes back up.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yep.
We played around with Dave, and then I had some free time, and you and I, we went out and did an E9, and I think we played the back nine, and
yep,
was probably one of the best driver days of my life, because I think I had the Hideki pause going, and I was ripping through the dang ball, and this was probably my best drive was on 17 and during our E9, and I remember thinking I was happy the drive did what I wanted it to do, but I was thinking to myself, I was an idiot if I was spraying it left and right. Like, still, you can find yourself in some really crappy positions on a par five driver hole if you're not in the fairway. And I just happened to be lucky, and I was like, man, I'm a moron, because I could have easily made a bungle of this hole if I'm, you know, far right with a slice, or just yank one.
But what's your alternative? Because it's pretty, I mean, it's,
I
pretty,
know it's far, yeah. So you gotta, I mean,
It is a driver hole.
It's probably worth the risk. Exactly.
Yeah. I do feel like if you miss, you are able to, unless it's the fall, you are typically able to find your ball and have at least something where you can hit it back out on the fairway. It's not like a, like what I struggle, and this is a weird comparison, what I struggle with CCC, for instance, is I feel like sometimes if you miss, you're just in this long crap, and you're like, your ball's gone.
Yeah.
And in Urbana, at least, and it's similar with Brookside, although there are a couple holes, but like, I feel like if I miss, I at least am like, okay, I can hit it back out on the fairway, maybe still make a bogey and move on with life. That's why I said at the beginning, I thought Urbana was a tiny bit more fair, just because I feel like I don't lose that many balls when I go to Urbana.
That's true.
So.
Yeah.
Yeah,
you're forced to hit a lot of shots under trees at Urbana.
Yeah, for sure.
I mean, do we want to? Can I? I'm going to share a little story about losing balls at Urbana.
Please do.
Playing with Neil Holland.
Please do.
Matt Farr is the kind of guy that plays with 12 plus balls in his bag. Caddies really hate him. Neil Holland plays with two, maybe one. Matt lost one of his two balls, and on the last ball, playing with you and your dad. I don't remember what hole we were on. It could have been the front nine. It could have been the back nine. You pull a ball from your bag, grab a Sharpie, and write, "Don't suck" on a ball. So mad at himself for losing so many balls.
I forgot about
and
that.
And I look at the ball, and we were cracking up laughing. Now, maybe it was the comedic relief that you needed.
Yeah.
I don't think you lost that ball, so hopefully you still have it somewhere. But
thankfully, we only had so one hole
mad,
left.
So mad at losing balls. It's funny you bring up. You don't lose many balls on this whole course, and that's
17 has no hazards. I mean, there's like, you know, it's like, how do you lose a ball in 17?
I don't know,
right?
If it was 17. Yeah. It could have been another hole.
Yeah. Like I said, though, in the fall,
the leaves,
you're gonna lose some balls.
That's true. That's true.
But and funny, same with Brookside. Funny you brought up losing balls, and I remember Matt at Urbana's right. Don't suck.
17 is like it's the shortest par five on the course, but it's also the toughest driving par five. So if you hit the fairway, you feel like, oh my gosh, you know, this poor golf hole has just suffered due to technology. Here I am hitting an 8-iron into the green. This is such a, you know, outdated hole. The very next time you play it, you can honestly, on that hole, you can hit the left side of the fairway and be blocked out from hitting the green. So it's just a hole that like requires a lot of accuracy, sometimes a little bit of luck, and it's a good hole. But I made an eagle already there this year. So now that I'm stating that out loud, like that'll be the last one of those. But 18, like you mentioned, 18 is your favorite hole out of the three at the end. It's It's a pretty sweet hole now that we've redone our patio.
Yeah, the patio is, it just kind of sells it for me, because it's, for those that don't know, the, it kind of goes up into the green, and then at the top, even more elevated, is like the patio that is then overlooking the green, and you get some pretty epic sunsets too. So, like, it's like kind of the combination of, it's a nice golf hole, but like the finishing hole, you can't get much better for like watching people finish than that type of setup at Urbana. So kudos to them for putting in a pretty impressive patio and deck area.
Yeah. The Dye family has obviously like meant a lot to Urbana in more ways than people care to realize, but they were also largely responsible for putting in that patio. And, you know, the amount of work that went into making that happen was awesome, and it made a huge impact. People stand around the fire pit now and watch people finish their round of golf. It's funny. I'll be up around the green, and, you know, if I have a putt for birdie and we're just playing for absolute nothing, you know, if you recognize somebody on the patio, you're like, yeah, they're going to be watching you putt. It's just a great place to, like, watch a round of golf finish up. And the club championship, like, environment out there is – very cool. You know, usually 30 to 40 people just standing around, you know.
Who's won the last making noise. Couple of club championships there?
I don't know.
You don't know?
I do not know.
Oh, but, yeah. All right. Yeah. Cool.
But
is three in a row?
Four
for
in
you?
A row?
Yeah. So
not including the ones from.
Yeah, I've got four in a row.
Yeah.
So you're challenging Chip for the 11 in a row streak.
Yeah, he's got 12. So I've got six total. We're 6 for 6 right now, so that's probably like the eagle on 17. That's not going to happen anymore. But it's a fun place. There's some good players. The, you know, Columbus Country Clubs, the Brookside, they have much deeper fields. So my club championship should be viewed on a different level for sure. But it's still fun. Like, the patio makes it an enjoyable experience. You always see members that you know. And you know, in any sport, like, performing under pressure is a lot of fun, right? Even if you're just playing against your buddies, which I'm sure we'll be doing throughout the summer.
Yeah.
You want to obviously, like, take you guys down just like we did, you know, at Columbus Country Club like a month ago, Tommy and I.
I do want to say, too, that
I have no team affiliation as of today.
Yeah, that's – you need to –
it sounds like you're signing on with the cliques.
No. The drive out to Urbana, too, if you're in the Columbus area, it's lovely. And
watch for sheriffs.
Yeah. Yes, watch for sheriffs. There will be some country sheriffs that will definitely give you a ticket if they. But it's a great drive. It's like farmland and trees and very relaxing, and it's very serene when you get out there, and peaceful, which is lovely. Not that Brookside and CCC aren't, but the drive to those places is a little more stressful, I would say. Given you're on Broad Street or 270, or I should say 315 and 161, so.
Yeah.
But.
Oh, boys, any final thoughts regarding Urbana?
No, it's always a lot of fun. Everyone's super friendly. Mm-hmm. You know, you go out there and you always feel welcome, and
100%.
Know, it's just a fun golf course. I do wish the practice facilities were a little bit better, but that, you know,
we need some improvements.
That's okay.
Yeah.
You don't
have any problems with people not raking their bunkers there, hey?
We need people to improve raking the bunkers.
Okay. That's not
scraping it a couple times does not suffice.
that's not just an Urbana thing. Just but no, it's, you know, I always enjoy getting the invite to go out and play.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun.
I like the, this is a weird thing to say, and I know we got to move on to the blind pour, apologies, the decor of Urbana Country Club is super cool, because they have intentionally not upgraded things since probably the 70s and 80s.
Yeah.
And it looks super cool. Like, it's like stuck in time, but like intentionally stuck in time, which I very much enjoy when we go out there.
I remember seeing 2012, I believe it was, like the first time I saw my name on the wall on the club championships plaque, and there are at least like 3 or 4 plaques, and you just start to see like 1944 club championship, and you're like, okay, this is kind of cool. You know, so like getting your, I mean, member guest champions, like ladies club championship, right? Like it's, I'm not just referencing my stuff, but like it's pretty cool if you see your name on the wall at Urbana, because there's so many people who are such better golfers and like more famous and more historical than you to play. And it's kind of nice that they haven't gotten rid of that stuff. They're welcome to take my name off the wall anytime, but like they still have the wallpaper. They still got, you know, like the red leather and the boosts, and yep, there's some things that haven't been updated. So it now like kind of leads you to wonder what life was like way back when people were eating in that dining room and stuff. And
yeah,
if Walter Hagen is playing the golf course when it was the nine hole golf course at Urbana Country Club, that stuff's fun to think about, but it's just a place that has a lot of history, and I would love to learn more. You know, selfishly, I just like to play golf, and I don't really dig into the history a lot, and you just kind of learn these stories from different members over the years, but it's a really cool place.
There's a book.
Yeah.
You know that?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I did not know that.
Shout out Julie Johnson.
Yeah.
All right.
What'd she write?
A book about the history of Urbana.
Oh, wow.
I believe her family was the was
Urbana
involved in
Country Club, or like Urbana
Country
the,
Club.
Okay, all right.
Julie's on the board.
Yeah,
all right,
still. Nice. Yep. She's on the board.
That's very cool.
Was it her family that owned the land that they sold was sold to the club to build the second nine?
I believe so.
I think so.
Yeah. So the land that sits behind the driving range, and then it would be left of hole number six, is it still belongs to her and her family. I'm not exactly sure like how anything's titled, obviously, but yeah, her family's been, you know, a big influence on the country club. They've obviously played a big role. So
I just searched for Urbana Country Club on Amazon, and what popped up, a PSA, which is a grading company that does sports cards, sports memorabilia, signed Urbana Country Club by who? Who do you think?
PB.
I mean, Paul Dye.
Jack.
Wow.
Nailed it.
Wow. Yeah. Okay.
Only $500, but pretty cool. Pretty cool.
Should add that to the golf barn, Mr. Milholland.
Yeah.
Jack Nicklaus.
That is pretty awesome. I don't know where else you'd actually find that, to be completely honest. Anyway, good stuff.
Oh, man. Well, how's the golf year been to start the year? You know, as we start sipping on this blind pour from Mr. Harmon. Thank you, Tommy.
Let's do a quick cheers.
Yeah, cheers.
It's been good. I feel like I've already played more golf this year than I did all of last year.
Love it. Are we reporting those scores?
Crazy.
Wow.
No, absolutely not. No, I've played, I think, two 18-hole rounds. Well, no. So one I played with you, right, Matt? And it was like 13 holes, 12 holes.
Yeah, we got to turn that in.
Yeah, you can post that now.
Not going to post that.
Why not?
I don't even remember what the score was. Then played one with you guys at CCC. Been out to the driving range twice, going to Hilton Head on Sunday, playing Oyster Reef. Just nine holes, though. And, yeah, so I'm really intentionally trying to just play more golf and enjoy it. And that's what I've been able to do so far. And it's May, what is it, 9th? It's like
10th.
10th, May 10th. Like, this is, you know, this is great. We've got spoiled with good weather in April, too, so. Yeah, so it's been good.
Me next, because
yeah,
I'm the least likely. Yeah, I'm on course to break my record from last year, which was 10. Already sitting at 4. Pushing myself towards the limit.
How are you doing that with a newborn? Can we just give a shout out to Amy here?
Yeah, the wife is a saint. And it's been hectic as well, given the work travel, coming back from leave, being on the road for work, yada, yada, yada. Excuses when it comes to the golf
game.
This
is the hobby, man.
But we've been blessed with some nice warm weather during the winter, and a couple of courses that don't charge anything to walk. So I've played with a brother-in-law once or twice, and it was during the dead period for logging everything in the Gin app, so I wasn't able to get that posted. Sorry, boys. But one of the goals from the start of this year was to have more rounds under 100 than over 100, and I'm so far checking that box. Hopefully we can finish
heck
the year.
Yeah,
that way.
Let's go.
Love it.
Already at 4 logged, probably 6 unlogged. a couple of range sessions with
the brother.
How
about this guy turning in his scores? How about that?
I signed up for a league.
Nobody's worried about Matt Farr turning in his scores.
I have one score, and I know exactly what it was. So it's all good.
I've got a league. Thankfully, my brother-in-law reached out to me, wanted to sign up for this, and I was all in on it. The travel in April and May has been awful, so I've only played once, and I won't play my second round until the end of May.
Yeah, for those that don't know, Matt came down to Hilton Head with us, went to the RBC.
Did not.
Oh, wait a second.
That sounds like a fun time.
Thanks for coming, Matt.
Appreciated. I was laughing listening back on the third podcast.
Oh, yeah.
We were talking about
said
our goals.
We were all going to Hilton Head.
You were talking about that. I was like, ha.
Yeah.
That didn't happen.
Shout out Scotty Scheffler. Let's go.
I still paid my debts, but I did not make it down. Work and family had other plans in mind. We don't need to rehash sore subject. Don't want to make you feel mad, Dave, but didn't get to do that. That's okay, though. I'm sure there'll be hopefully other invites, and unless I've screwed the pooch there and haven't been able to get another invite. But
yeah, you're done.
Yeah, it's been so far. It's been a decent start, and the league is nice because it's going to give me what I was looking for in terms of playing consistently at a similar place. It's a beautiful course. Denison is actually really cool.
Oh yeah,
oh yeah,
that's great golf course.
I've only played it once, and I've only played the front nine.
It's so challenging.
I like it. So far, it's a good start to the year.
There was a house for sale for the longest time on...
Is that the one behind number three green, number two green?
I think it's behind a tee box. It has a pool, and it like overlooks the course. It was awesome. Hmm. Unfortunately, it was 40 minutes in the opposite of direction where we had to move. So, but it looked super cool.
Yeah, it looked cool.
Anyway.
Tommy?
I mean, I felt decent. I look back on last year, and I think I had logged about 5 rounds prior to July 1st. I'm up to 2, so that feels good. I don't feel like I've necessarily gotten the golf season going yet. Hopefully, as work slows down, I can figure out some ways to, you know, get out and get a few rounds in and figure out how to play golf again. But, you know, nothing too crazy.
Yeah. Yeah, I've played probably 6 or 7 rounds, I guess, if you include. I played twice out in Arizona. Nice. And, so it's been a good start, but it's really tough to just kind of get things going. You know, you play a couple rounds and then the weather changes.
Yeah.
And then you don't play for another week, and then the weather gets great. And I feel like in this time of year, you either get lucky with your schedule being clear on the right days, or you get unlucky. Like you mentioned, I think it's going to be 80 on Monday. Well, congratulations. Like I can't play golf on Monday.
Right.
So sometimes it just falls that way. But
I actually lied. I've played 3 rounds because I played in January.
Wow.
Yeah, I know.
How have I played the least number of rounds?
I don't know.
That
seems like a you problem.
Is it unique that his January round, it falls outside of the reporting season?
Don't make the better golfers better. You make the worser golfers better.
Worser.
Yeah. Oh, my gosh. Okay. We got to talk about this bourbon. I mean, this is an unbelievably unique taste. I mean, I have a...
Definitely weird nose, but the palate's got... it's an ever-changing palate.
I was expecting sweeter when I smelled and was like, oh, that's like...
You're expecting sweeter?
Yes.
I'm getting very sweet. I'm getting
I don't think it's as sweet as the Buffalo Trace, though.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. I don't know.
This is one of the most unique tasting bourbons I've had since a particular night with Colin, future guest on the podcast.
Maybe it's my nose today, but it doesn't... The palate is different than what I'm expecting from the nose. It's just... there's some sweetness on the nose for me, not as much as maybe you guys, but... I haven't figured it out yet, so come back to me. I'm still perplexed on the palate.
I mean, once again,
are you getting higher proof? Do you feel like it's like more in the 110s?
No, undetermined on proof, but if I had to pull the trigger today, right now, I'd say that it's somewhere 100.
I think it's between 110 and 120. Okay. That's my guess.
Yeah, but that would be sweet. My guess too.
Okay. I threw this word out, but I'm getting citrus when I taste it. When I smell it, I think, okay, cool. This is, I know I hate to use the word neutral when describing the smell of a bourbon, but like I smelled it, smelled like bourbon. And I didn't get anything like flash into my nose. I smelled it like four times before I tasted it. There was nothing to me unique about the smell. And then I tasted it. My eyes got big because I was like, wait a minute, what's going on here? I kind of looked at you guys to see if I was getting any sort of a reaction.
Yeah, like initial thoughts were floral, hibiscus floral.
Yeah.
Now that you say citrus, maybe some of that's creeping in, or maybe it's the mental complex, but zero spice, like no. Rye.
That's nothing. I was trying to put my finger on it. I'm not getting the citrus. I'm not getting more of the floral.
I'm not getting like baking spices, no spice, zero spice.
Yeah.
So very florally.
Tommy's going to be like, actually, guys, this is a tequila.
Well,
it's not a tequila.
Without revealing yet, like, what are your thoughts on it?
I'm with you guys. I think there's a lot going on. Lots of, you know, each sip seems to have, you know, something unique and different, which is kind of fun to, you know, kind of fun to sit back and try and digest it.
I just got raisin on the last one. Like I don't know, man. Ooh. I'm perplexed.
I get the citrus note too, that you were talking about, Matt. But I do. I get a lot of sweetness, and you know, it just seems to change each sip, which is kind of fun.
Yeah, I would agree.
Very complex. Are we throwing out guesses?
We can.
I think it's a Barrel Craft Spirits product. Because of the uniqueness. So I mentioned, I'll preface this, and I forget which bottle it was, but my brother-in-law, Colin, he brought a bottle. It was aged in rum barrels. It was a Barrel Craft Spirits product, and it was like
crazy,
far and away the most unique tasting bourbon I've ever had. And as soon as I took a first sip of this one, I thought, oh my gosh, this reminds me of that night. So I don't know if it's the same thing, like in the rum barrels, or not, but like I know Barrel's doing some really unique stuff. I also know, you know, after listening to our Goals podcast, that Tommy's wanted to explore Found North a little bit more, so maybe some like insider baseball there, and I'm guessing Found North. But my true gut reaction when I first tasted it was, this is a Barrel Craft Spirits product.
Yeah.
So
I feel like it's some sort of barrel strength type. I'm gonna go Penelope.
Ooh, that's a good
and
guess.
Go a little bit weird. I've only had two different types of Penelope, and it's been a little bit, but I feel like when I had them, I remembered them being, I don't want to say confusing, but like complex, which I do feel like every time I have a sip of this, you nailed it, Tommy. I feel like I'm getting slightly different tastes of things. So
I've yet to have, they're not all amazing 5 out of 5 necessarily, but I've yet to have a disappointing Penelope product.
They're solid.
I think they're good. Mm-hmm. So depends on the batch, and I know they got, you know, different series, things like that, but I think they're good. Matt, you and Tommy are the experts here. I know. Yeah, you're probably just over here wheeling and dealing and making sales, but what do you think about this bourbon?
Whoever mentioned the rum finished, I was also slightly thinking that. And then, Matt, you said barrel, and that's where my mind was going as well. The Tale of Two Islands barrel bourbon cask finish was kind of the thought that came to mind. I've never had it. I've only read a review of it, had an option to buy, passed on it. So I was trying to flip through the paragraph intro on it to see if it fit with maybe what I'm thinking. Yes and no. So maybe I'm overthinking it and getting to it too in depth on all this. But if I'm pulling the trigger now, I'm going to go with that one on the Tale of Two Islands from a barrel.
I don't know if it's that bottle or not, but when you said the word island, I thought, boy, if you put some ice in this drink, you could certainly drink this particular bourbon on the beach. I think it, for me, it's sweet enough. So I don't know. But yeah.
That's I'll try it next week.
On the beach. Rub it in, you Mr. Oyster Golfer.
I thought the same that you, because I know Tommy's goal was to try to explore barrel a little bit more. So same. I'm limiting, I've blinders on, narrowed the scope to the barrel side. But prior to me jumping down that rabbit hole, I didn't have anything else. I don't know of anything that's been.
I went against the grain. I feel like he wasn't going to use barrel because he listened to the episode too. Is he going to lean into barrel or move away from it? I don't know.
I'm sure he is.
Well,
but also, I mean, Penelope, I don't really know. Yeah, I don't really know much about, so I can't tell you whether or not it was a good guess.
I can tell you. It probably wasn't, but
I'm also perplexed given the last time he did the blind for us as the larger group.
Yeah, it was blind.
He definitely set us up. However, he fell back on something that he wanted to do for a long time. So I'm now in the position of trying to guess the pourer, and that's knowing Tommy and that grin over there. That's a bad position.
Is this where he goes, "Hey guys, this is old Rip Van Winkle.
we got some old elk over here, or some brand that we've never touched."
I would say, hold on, we didn't do ratings.
Not yet. Do we want to do that after we find out what it is?
No, I think we do it before.
Okay.
Yeah. I'm doing a 325. I actually like it. I think it's a really good. I'm enjoying it. I'm expecting it to be a lot hotter initially, and it's not. And I actually like that.
Yeah.
It's not too sweet for me compared to Buffalo Trace. Which is what we just had. I feel like it's not as sweet. I could be way off, but I'm very drinkable. Like super super complex flavors. Good bourbon. Yeah.
Just as a reminder, our rating system is 1 to 5. Technically 0 to 5, quarter points only. If you're wondering, like, oh, you gave it a great rating, 3.25. Yes, it's on a scale of 0 to 5.
That means, like, so I would probably buy it if I saw it.
Yep.
That's what 3 means, right?
Yep.
Is
3, yep.
If I see it on the shelf, I'll buy it.
I'll grab it.
4 is I'm going to seek it out and go try to find it.
Yep.
And 5 is just kind of unicorn status, and we've never rated anything a 5.
Yeah. Correct. Must have, I'll overpay for it, that kind of thing. So, yeah. I'm along that lines. I'm torn between 3.25 and 3.5 because I think the uniqueness is trying to push me to a 3.5
mm-hmm.
because I really appreciate that there's something different about this bourbon. Does that mean I think it's better? And some of the other stuff I've tasted, I don't know. I mean, how do you define better? I would say, like, it's very enjoyable. I'll probably give it the benefit of the doubt and just say 3.5 because of the surprise factor that I got when I drank it. So, I don't know. We'll go with 3.5.
Yeah, but before you guys gave the ranking, I was at 3.5. I'm still there. But I say that to say that you guys haven't influenced it. It was when you said 3.25. I was like, okay, I'm in the ballpark. You said between 2.5 and 0.5.
Yeah.
I think the ever changing palate is why I'm giving it that extra nod.
Yeah.
Of
for sure.
Intrigue, and the fact that it doesn't taste super hot. I like higher proof. I wouldn't be surprised if this comes out as a higher proof. I wouldn't be surprised if it's a 90 proof. And the fact that it has that much flavor, whether it's a 90 proof or a 125 proof, it's so drinkable that you're not, it's not going to melt your face.
Nope.
So I like it.
It's a great description. Yeah.
Do you think that, like, bourbon experts would say that this is too complex? Like, it's too difficult to identify exactly what's going on, because I feel like when I watch reviews or I read reviews of different bourbons, they say, oh, you know, like, I'm going to kind of dock at some points because I'm really unable to pick out how many flavors I'm actually tasting and experiencing. Because I kind of get that with this one, but I'm giving it credit for that. I think it's getting points for uniqueness in my mind, whereas I feel like other people say, oh, I can't really pull the caramel. I can't really pull the citrus. I can't pull
X, I don't think Y, I Z. Like, I don't think I'd want to drink this by itself forever. Like, but that's it's fair. A great, like, you want something a little different.
If you want a summertime bourbon,
yeah, there you go. Exactly. That's a great. That's a great. Yeah, that's a great example.
I to answer your question, sure. There's probably a few that would. There's probably a few that wouldn't. And if you're a purist, maybe you dock it a couple of points because you don't like the. Uniqueness of it, but I don't.
Bourbon is such a like a long term. Like it's been done in the same way or similar ways for so long.
Centuries.
Yeah, and I feel like anyone that's willing to try something a little different or like the taste is adjusted a little bit is worthy of a good grade and my money.
Let's get Tommy's rankings on this one.
Tommy, wipe that grin off your face and give us some details.
give it a ranking first and then tell us.
I'm in the same boat. It's 3.5, 3.75 for me.
It's a barrel.
I really enjoy the uniqueness to it and the, you know, just differences as you each sip trying to pick out something new and being able to find something new is, you know, it's certainly not a one-trick pony.
Like I just got cinnamon. I swear.
My first thought was like, could this be the Amberana finish? But I was like, nah, I don't get any cinnamon, so I don't think it's that. But
I'm gonna get
my mind blown when
so that's mine
like,
outside.
Oh yeah, it's the Amberana finish from Barrel or somebody else. Starlight Amberana finish. It's cinnamon.
Well,
forward.
You know what? That's a good call. I mean, sorry to go away from you, Tommy, but that Starlight is doing some unique stuff. So that maybe it's that. But continue.
So let's see what,
he starts off, he goes, it's not Starlight.
It is not Starlight.
Or Penelope.
It is not Penelope. It is 120 proof.
Okay. Yeah.
So see? On the high side there, but
nailed it
in the realm. What details do you want next?
I mean, we got to get the distiller.
Yeah. I mean like
how about 70% corn? 29% rye, 1% barley.
There we go.
29% rye.
29% rye.
There we go.
Surprising.
Let's see what else.
Well, that's like, I mean, I'm not an expert, but that's like why there was less spices, right? Like, is like less rye.
29% still pretty heavy rye.
Is 29% pretty high?
For what I was tasting, I would have said that there was maybe 8% rye.
The Buffalo Trace stuff's like
15.
The high rise, 12.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like,
not
what's the corn percentage on Buffalo products?
Typically? Pretty high.
Yeah, like 70 or they, like they, 80 even.
They don't disclose it. But okay. Like my sense is it's, you know, the high rye ones, you know, 83, 12, 5 or something. Like it's pretty high corn.
Yeah.
Which gives it the sweetness that you taste.
Right.
Is it a finished?
It is.
Mm.
It has to be.
Okay.
It is a blend.
Is it finished in rum?
Oh no. Are we getting a Bardstown?
Rum
bourbon?
Is not one of the finishes.
Is it finished? It's not sherry.
No sherry. There are several finishes.
Oh,
jeez.
Oh, no.
which is why.
This could be Bardstown.
I'm just going to try.
Triple finish.
It's not Bardstown.
Hit us with it.
Hit us with it.
Ages of 12 to 26 years.
Oh, gosh.
Wow.
Apple brandy.
Has to be barrel.
Hungarian oak. Amaran. Wine casks. Ex-Scotch casks. Ex-American oak cask. You said it.
Barrel.
Not barrel.
Really? Rum cask?
I did take some inspiration from our goals episode.
Okay.
Okay.
It is not barrel, but it is found north.
Yeah.
Wow. All right.
This is we had talked about them bringing out single barrels, and I had mentioned that I did not get a chance to get the R Bourbon single barrel.
Mm-hmm.
But when they released the safety casks, or the safety cases, I did get one of the R Bourbon single barrels.
Nice.
So this is the R Bourbon 01, codename Smokeless.
That's a great
single
name
barrel
for it. Because there's zero smoke. So
it makes me feel better about, like, I'm not in any way, shape, or form as advanced as these crazy people in here, but it makes me feel slightly better about my palate when I was like, yeah, I don't know what just happened when my first drink. I was like, I feel like I at least kind of understand bourbon. I just was so just shocked at the couple of sips that I first took.
Well, fun fact, it's not bourbon.
Yeah, there we go.
Call it what it is.
It's whiskey.
Blended Canadian whiskey.
Indeed.
Well, and I would have never guessed Found North. I've only tried Found North products one time, courtesy of Tommy, and it was very good, but I don't own anything else, so I don't have anything to try, or I don't have a track
how
record
hard
to go
is
off
it,
of.
How hard is it to find Found North? I have never looked for it in any...
I mean, it depends on where you are.
Difficult.
It's not easy.
Yeah.
And it's getting much harder.
Okay.
Exactly. They're getting a lot of steam.
Yeah. What was the price of the bottle excluding shipping? Because obviously we would never order like bottles online.
That's yeah, definitely guess. Not. You know, it was 110.
Okay.
I think. Somewhere around there.
I was going to say 120, but yep.
Could have been 120, but somewhere in that neighborhood.
So is it fair? I know that they're different and they're labeled differently, and this is Canadian whiskey technically, right?
Yep.
But is it fair to put like Barrel, Bardstown, Found North kind of in the same category? It seems like all three of those companies are doing some unique things where they're doing some blending, they're doing some finishing, they're doing multiple types of finishing. The price ranges seem the same, you know, like you're always getting an $80 to $160 bottle. It seems like they're expensive, but
yeah, I mean I think what they're doing is similar, right? They're all three of those pride themselves on their ability to blend different components, different whiskeys together and come up with something that's interesting, unique, cohesive. I mean, Barrel and Bardstown focus more on the, you know, bourbon rye, you know, American sort of whiskeys. Found North sources everything from Canada, which is unique and different because the quote unquote mash bill that I read off in Canada, they're doing runs of 100% corn, 100% rye, 100% malt. Like, and then they're actually the malt comes from the rye. But they're basically doing single grain distillation. And then on the back end, they Found North is blending it together to come up with, you know, the quote unquote grain ratio, which conceptually, you know, in theory, you can kind of control that a little bit, as opposed to, you know, your mash bill pre-distillation of, I'm going to put, 80% corn, 10%, 15% rye and 5% barley together.
Yeah.
Distill it all together, throw it in the barrel and see what happens. So, you know, in theory, you can come up with, you can control it a little bit better, but that's where the quote unquote mash bill of the Found North or the Canadian whiskey differs a little bit because it's post distillation. It's the, you know, it's the grain ratio of the liquid that they've distilled. So,
well, thank you for the pour. This was very unique, very good.
Yeah.
And it's always good to like try stuff from different distilleries that we haven't experienced before. So I knew immediately I was not tasting an Elijah Craig product. I can tell you that much. So, guys, this about wraps it up. I mean, fourth episode of Pour for the Course. We'll be back with more golf reviews. We're going to try to get the content out as consistently as possible, but you're dealing with four guys and three of which who have young kids. So we'll try and hopefully the interns can get episodes 1 and 2 out on the interweb. So
he'll make it work.
Yeah.
We're good.
Until after Dave's additional trip to Hilton Head Island, we'll see you guys on the other side. So thank you again. Cheers.
Cheers.
Cheers, y'all.
Cheers.